DW, Living Planet, with Sam Baker.
Today on Living Planet, we learn about a community in Chile that's fighting industrial pollution on multiple fronts. And later, we hear from James Thornton, an environmental lawyer whose client is the Earth. But first, some states in America have taken a decidedly different approach to climate change following President Donald Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement. California is one state that's committed to an emissions-free future. With a population of nearly 40 million and an economy that's bigger than the United Kingdom's, how difficult will it be for the biggest state in the U.S. to transition to an entirely clean energy grid? And why are environmentalists arguing about wind power? Timothy McDonald reports from Northern California.
I'm standing on a hill outside of the small town of Rio Vista. It's about an hour and a half drive from San Francisco. And this is an important area for wind energy here in Northern California. There are wind turbines just about as far as the eye can see in almost every direction. But even though this is a massive wind farm, it's probably not really producing much energy today because it's just completely dead. There are a few turbines turning lazily in the distance, but most of them are completely still. And it just underscores some of the challenges that California will face as it heads towards a zero emissions future.
And the goal is for an emissions-free electricity supply in California by 2045. So will they be able to do it?
I think that the rate we're going, it's going to happen much faster than that.
That's Mark Jacobson, an engineering professor from Stanford University, and he's optimistic that the transition is both manageable and affordable.
Solar in particular is taking off, and offshore wind, floating offshore wind, is now being zoned and sited and permitted off the California coast, and that's like the biggest resource of energy available, and the costs of offshore wind have dropped tremendously. Now they're even competitive with gas.
There's actually not too much disagreement in California when it comes to renewables. The state currently has a Democratic governor, but its last Republican governor, a certain well-known muscle-bound Austrian-born former actor, also had a strong commitment to renewables.
We flexed our muscles and we made a commitment and we created action.
That was Arnold Schwarzenegger speaking at the Paris Climate Change Conference in 2015. This time, the main objections to the legislation came from the utility providers, and they weren't fighting over the principle so much as the roadmap. Pacific Gas and Energy told DW that it's committed to renewables, but if it's not affordable, it's not sustainable. Catherine Phillips from the Sierra Club says even the utility's own numbers show that it's not an undue burden financially.
The increased efficiencies, storage facilities, the battery storage or other storage facilities, the costs there are unknown at this point, but there's the great potential that, just as all these other technologies have, the costs will go dramatically down as they're adopted.
This gas power plant, just down the road from the wind farm, has a 10-year guarantee to supply power to Pacific Gas and Energy. But obviously, there are questions about what happens to assets like this as California changes its energy mix. And as more renewables are introduced, the grids have to adapt too. And that's something utilities have also expressed concern over.
A lot of work ahead. No time for victory laps.
That's V. John White, the executive director of the Center for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Technologies. He agrees that the grid will be something of a challenge.
The grid was originally a one-way street, right? Power coming from the grid into your house. Now we have it coming back out, and we're seeing customers not only just providing solar through feed-in tariffs and stuff like that, but also providing services to the utility. So it becomes a smarter grid, a more resilient grid, but it requires planning. And this is where I think we need to do a better job of integrated planning.
But history shows that grids will adapt, according to Mark Jacobson.
And the adaption, it's not like you need all of a sudden in one day you're going to have 100% renewables having had 0% the day before. I mean, this does happen over time. I mean, it's happening rapidly. But experience shows that grids adapt. I mean, it used to be said that you couldn't have more than 20% renewables on the grid at a time. But now we have states like Iowa has 42% on average in the year and sometimes 70% on the grid.
So, problem solved. The grid will adapt and renewables will be affordable. Everybody's happy, right? Well, not exactly.
It's been the frustration of my life to deal with the environmentalists on wind energy siting issues.
Right. So did you ever think it would be environmentalists that you'd be fighting over these issues?
Well, I have been fighting them for about 7 or 8 years. So, before that, maybe I didn't understand how what a roadblock it was going to be, but I certainly do now.
That's Nancy Rader, the executive director of the California Wind Energy Association. She says in theory, the legislation is great. What renewable energy advocate wouldn't want a 100% target? The devil, though, is in the details. She says many people and governments love wind power just as long as you put it somewhere else.
We've placed about 5,000 megawatts in California, and we may not see much more than 1,000 megawatts or 2,000. And that's because cities and counties have largely said no to more wind energy. And the state and federal governments have said no to more wind energy in the vast California desert, which is kind of our next frontier.
You can avoid the not-in-my-backyard problem by putting turbines out at sea, but that's typically more expensive. For turbines on land, the problem is that some people simply don't like how they look. But it's environmental issues too, like the impact of turbines on rare tortoises or longhorn sheep. Nancy Rader says something's got to give.
Those same people that have those feelings are going to have to overrule the relatively few number of people that have to look at the wind and solar in the desert and other unpopulated areas and overcome the objections of a few. And so I'm hopeful that someday that will occur. And if it doesn't occur, I don't see how we meet these goals.
Others, like Catherine Phillips, are a little more optimistic.
I think environmentalists don't like to say that cutting one environmental impact is more important than cutting another environmental impact. I mean, that's always, you don't want to play Solomon. But,
but at some point, don't you have to?
I don't think we've gotten to that point yet. That's the thing. We might get to that point, but I don't think we have. I think there are plenty of innovators out there, especially in the wind area. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of places to appropriately place turbines. There's lots of opportunity for solar. There's still some geothermal, a lot of geothermal that hasn't been tapped.
For now, the question might be if one environmental value will have to make way for another. Timothy McDonald in Northern California for DW.
In Chile, a poisonous cloud has been hovering over the Bay of Quintero Puchuncavi. Residents are complaining of respiratory problems, dizziness, and vomiting. Chileans call it the sacrifice zone because local inhabitants and nature are being sacrificed to industrial development in the country. The World Health Organization and the United Nations Human Rights Council have expressed concern about the situation. Sophia Boddenberg filed this report, which is narrated by Ruby Russell.
The Bay of Quintero Puchuncavi in Chile used to be a peaceful summer paradise, a tourist destination where colourful fishing boats drifted peacefully on the water. Around 40,000 people lived in the area, and tourism and fishing were its main sources of employment. But in the 1960s, the bay began to become the centre of Chilean industrial development. Thermal power plants soon appeared, and some of the country's biggest and dirtiest companies moved their headquarters to the bay. Petrochemical outfit Oxyquim, gas company Gasmar, and mining company Codelco, as well as the national petroleum company ENAP, were among them. Today, Quintero Puchuncavi's beaches are empty. Clouds of dark smog loom on the horizon, and fishermen struggle to make a living. Claudio Hernandez leads the Fishermen's Union in Quintero. It formed in 2014 after an accident involving the state oil company ENAP, which spilled 30,000 litres of oil into the sea.
We have been harmed a lot. For 4 years since the oil spill in 2014, we have been fighting against contamination. We are the only group of fishermen that have spoken up. The other groups are all corrupted by the companies, and they keep their mouths shut. There are many young fishermen that want to continue with the art of fishing, but there are not many fish left, and the traders won't buy our fish anymore because of the contamination.
Fear as well as bribes keep the fishermen in Quintero quiet. Several environmental activists have been killed in Chile over recent years. Last October, Alejandro Castro, a 27-year-old fisherman and union leader from Quintero, died in mysterious circumstances. The official cause of death was suicide, but many in the community believe he was murdered. Alejandro Ochoa works for an ENAP contractor and is a member of the Quintero Pucuncaví Bay Industrial Union. He is also part of Quintero Pucuncaví's Environmental Recovery Council, a body of civil society, government and industry representatives. He says that health problems are rife among workers in Quintero.
The health issue is nothing new. We have always fought against the pollution because we are the first ones who suffer from poisoning. We are the victims of a brutal neoliberal system in Chile that has no social component. If the companies don't take the responsibility for the workers, they won't take the responsibility for the communities either. The government doesn't care about what happens in Quintero.
Alejandro Ocha says children are at particular risk. Last October, air pollution levels in the area hit a new peak. 17-year-old student Tara Pizarro remembers it clearly.
Many of my classmates were missing. The teacher arrived and told us there was gas poisoning, but he didn't know much more. Other children had headaches and were vomiting and fainting. I was sick and dizzy, but I didn't know why. Many of my classmates had to go to the hospital. Some of them were unconscious. Some couldn't move their legs. It was horrible. Now they put up some air purifiers in our classrooms, but they don't really help because they don't filter out toxic gases.
More than 50 students and teachers were hospitalised that day. According to the Chilean Ministry of Health, 1,398 people were treated for gas poisoning in local hospitals between September 21st and October 18th last year. The situation hasn't changed much since.
We had some days off, then we went back to class and were poisoned again. We were living it every day. We couldn't even study without someone starting to vomit. That hasn't stopped and it won't stop. Not now, not in 2 years. That's why we demand that they should respect the World Health Organization's standards and improve the learning conditions in the schools.
Tara Pizarro and her classmates have taken to the streets to demand a healthy environment for Quintero's youth. Younger members of the community with weaker immune systems are hit hardest by pollution. The government sent a team of experts to the area who detected more than 120 different gases in the air. One was methyl chloroform, also known as trichloroethane, which fits with the symptoms Quintero residents have complained of: dizziness, headaches and vomiting. The chemical has been banned in Chile since 2015. But many suspect OxyChem, which marketed trichloroethane for many years, as the source of the leak. The company denies selling or using the chemical substance since it was banned 3 years ago. But just a few months ago, OxyChem appeared as a supplier of trichloroethane on a website for chemical products. In a statement, the company said, "We can assure you that our processes are unrelated to the events and that OxyChem does not use, market or store any of the components associated with the damages in Quintero Pucuncaví." The state oil company ENAP also issued a statement saying that it regretted the situation in Quintero and that all studies carried out show that ENAP is not responsible for these events. Locals want the authorities to step in and hold whoever is responsible to account. But Maria Araya says the state has other priorities.
We are fighting against the country's economic powers. There are 18 polluting companies. Two are state-owned and the others are private. It's very unlikely that the state is going to respond to what is really happening. They sacrifice our children's lives for money. We are the economic center of the country. If they close one company, the whole economy collapses.
Locals call Quintero Pucuncavi Bay the Zona del Sacrificio, the sacrifice zone, because they feel their health and well-being has been laid on the altar of economic growth. Sebastian Santos is spokesperson for the local council in Quintero.
No hay análisis de metales pesados ni propiamente tal de los gases.
There are no studies about heavy metals or the gases that have affected people, nor are there any about the rates of cancer. But we know that many people have family members with cancer. We don't only have air pollution, we also have soil and marine pollution. The regulations in Chile don't reach the international standards. They can be up to 5 times higher than the ones established by the International Health Organization. The state is an accomplice of the industry. It makes regulations that allow the industry to produce this way and contaminate the people, the ecosystem, and the whole environment.
The council is demanding state regulation of industrial companies and wants an investigation to establish the exact causes of various instances of poisoning. The World Health Organization has warned of high levels of arsenic in the area, which can be absorbed into the water. The average arsenic concentration in Quintero and Pucuncavi, according to a study by the Chilean Ministry of Health, is 23 times higher than that allowed in the European Union. Birgit Gestenberg, the United Nations Regional Representative for South America, visited the region and expressed concern over the impact of pollution on the local population. She pointed out that the state is supposed to be committed to protecting human rights through legislation and institutions.
Dos gardenias para ti. Con ella quiero decir, te quiero, te adoro, mi vida. Ponle toda tu atención, que serán tu corazón y el mío.
That last report was narrated by Ruby Russell and filed by Sophia Bodenberg. Finally on the show today, James Thornton is head of the public interest law firm, Client Earth. The organization is known for holding governments to account for environmental damage, particularly in Europe. He recently spoke with DW's Anke Rosper about how he harnesses the law on behalf of his client and how he hopes to change the world.
I'm James Thornton, and I'm the CEO of Client Earth.
Mr. Thornton, you've been called one of the 10 people in the world that can really change the world. What's your master plan?
Well, the thing that really allows a small group of people to change the world is using the enormous power in the law. So legal systems encapsulate really what a society thinks about itself and the rules that people in a particular society have mutually agreed to be governed by. It always includes enforcement mechanisms. So if, for example, a government has passed a law about air pollution or water pollution, and then it doesn't do the right thing and protect the people, like the law says, we, using the power of the law, can go to the courts and force the government to do the right thing. So that's an example of how just a few people can actually make a big difference.
How many cases are you involved in Client Earth at the moment?
About 30 air quality cases going on now in 10 countries in the EU. We have another about 50 cases about coal. So I guess there are 110 cases, something like that, going on right now. And in another year or two, the list will be much longer.
And there are a couple where already the court has said there have to be diesel bans. Berlin is one of them. What do you hope to achieve?
I think many, many more will follow. So what is beginning to happen? In Germany, there are all of these cases. In other countries, we're now beginning to see that when we simply write a letter to the politicians, they decide to make the changes themselves. It doesn't always happen, and then we have to sue. But after our case went up to the highest court in Germany and we won, then the mayor of Rome, who had only had a polite letter from us, she had a press conference and announced that she wanted to protect the health of the people by banning diesel. That's a very, very good result. And what we hope to get is, as we bring all of these cases, you begin to hope that the governments decide they will, on their own, follow the law. It's not actually asking very much. to have governments follow their own law. So the very first thing we did as an organization, when we only had four people, was to sue Germany, the UK, and the EU in front of this court in Geneva, and we won all three cases. What that meant was that the German parliament went on a project of changing the standing laws to make it easier to bring a case if you're a citizen. In the UK, the cost rules changed so that now citizens can afford to bring cases. And in the EU, we won our case, but we're still fighting to get into the courthouse. It's not completely finished. The interesting thing is that we win most of our cases. We very seldom lose anything.
What does it take?
It takes a lot of hard work. You need to do a lot of analysis. And we always start by studying the science. So in setting up Client Earth, one of the very first things I did was to talk to climate scientists. If we could do one thing to help slow down climate change, what would it be? They said, stop any new coal-fired power stations from being built in Europe, and then start closing down existing coal-fired power stations. And then the question is there a strategy that can work? Sometimes it's not an obvious strategy. Sometimes you need to use very different sorts of laws to get to where you want to go. We're quite good at using existing environmental laws, but things aren't going fast enough. What else can we do? Suppose we were able to use corporate law, securities law, company law, and to make companies analyze the climate risk of their behavior, tell their investors that they were increasing the problems of climate change, and when they made their own investments, have to take account of the risk and invest in the right things. We now have 10 people working on this, and it's working very, very well. I'll give you an example. We just brought a very cool case in Poland, and it's the first case of its kind in the world. A company called Enea, which is another big energy company, they wanted to build a coal-fired power station. Now, energy analysts said that this would be a bad investment. They wouldn't make money from it. Coal is no longer a good investment. But they decided to go on anyway because the government is the biggest shareholder and it, for political reasons, wanted to move ahead. So we said, okay, let's try something new. We bought shares in the company. We became shareholders. After buying the shares, we sued the officers and directors of the company, saying that they're violating their duties under corporate law, not environmental law, by not taking the interests of the company and the shareholders into account by investing in this bad, bad investment coal plant. So that's the first time anyone in the world has done this. And I think officers and directors of companies all over the world are going to notice. And of course, we'll bring more of this type of cases, and we will change their behavior.
So what qualities do you think you need most?
Well, you need to believe that what you're doing makes sense. So, you know, is my whole life committed to trying to save civilization and trying to protect the planet and everyone who lives on it? And the answer is yes. So I don't know anything that I could be doing with myself that is as anywhere near as interesting to me as a human being. If that's your primary focus, you know, you find the energy. And also, I'm a Buddhist. And in Buddhism, you take a vow to save all sentient beings. You know, the sentient beings I'm trying to save are every man, woman, and child, and all of the animals, and all of the trees. There are some countries where it would be impossible to do our sort of work. We're always building the rule of law wherever we work. So we're building the rule of law in the EU. So in Africa, we are working in five countries, and we've been working there for about 4 years now. And the legal systems, the quality of the legal systems varied. In Gabon, for example, we had to bring together all of the forestry law. We actually went and found all the law and published what's now the official forestry code of Gabon. We wound up working with the government there and in these other four countries, a total of five. We started working with citizen groups and not the government. We started by working with NGOs and lawyers in the countries to explore what the legal rights of forest-dependent communities are so we could protect those rights. And as a result, with African lawyers, studied what the system of rights were in each country to see what rights were missing. We came up with a package of rights altogether, and in some countries there were things missing, and then we supported the NGOs in going to the governments and saying we need more of this right or we need more of that right. So in a sense, we've been working with the NGOs and lawyers in Africa in these countries to build basic democracy. And it's been remarkably successful. And in each of the countries, the governments then came to us and said, well, actually we understand what you're doing and it's quite helpful. Could you also talk to us? So we said, well, of course. And then changes in the law came.
And of course, that's also something that you're very excited about, is working in China. What do you do there, and what's so exciting about it?
Well, China is very exciting. We've just been discussing how in Western Europe, sometimes we have to fight governments. We also help them. But in China, in fact, the invitation was from the Supreme Court of China to go in and for me to give a seminar to members of the Supreme Court, because they were helping to write a law to allow citizens to sue companies that polluted for the first time. They set up a system of environmental courts from the Supreme Court all the way down to the provincial level. So there are something like 3,000 environment court judges in China who are becoming expert in deciding environmental cases. And it's been a real honor that the Supreme Court invited us to help train these judges in how to make environmental decisions. So every year, several times, we and bringing experts from around the world go in and share methodologies on how to decide environmental cases. And since we've been working with them for a few years now, the prosecutors have brought 2,000 enforcement cases in the courts. So to me, it's always very inspiring to go to China.
I'm sure you get a lot of criticism about this, because if you're focusing on environment and leave out human rights questions and social questions, would you say it's a rather pragmatic approach?
Well, let's think about it this way. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, very recently told us that we have 12 years to seriously shift the direction of society if we want a human civilization in future generations. 12 years, that's not very long. So if I were to sit here and say, well, I'm not going to help the Chinese improve their environmental work until they've completely changed their human rights position, 12 years might come and go many times, and the world might not survive from an environmental perspective. So I think one has to be pragmatic, and one has to actually help the world's biggest polluter and the world's largest population.
What cases are you most proud of that you won in the last 40 years?
One that I'm very proud of having brought was in California, to protect the whole coastal ecosystem from Los Angeles down to the border of Mexico. A long negotiation in which most of that coast got protected. So that was a particularly good one. And then I love bringing these cases against water polluters and against coal-fired power stations because it makes such a difference. You know, in Poland, we had a coal-fired power station closed down. The citizens in that city came to the office and they said, we'd like you to focus on this one, please, because it puts out so much benzene and other toxic chemicals. We have very high rates of cancer and other diseases. Could you close this down? So my colleagues there brought a case, and within 8 months, the plant was closed. So there's a lot to appreciate in a case like that, too.
Sounds like fun.
It is fun. It's a lot of fun. That's the other thing that keeps you going.
What's your next goal in the next 5 years for Kind Earth?
Well, it in some degree is a moving target, because as we were discussing earlier, we and all human beings have this 12 years in order to make a big difference. So we're going to be pushing very hard for new good laws, for example, to improve agriculture and reduce its contribution to climate change and pollution. And that's writing laws, you know, in the parliament. And then we're going to be bringing a lot more cases to be at the sharp point of disrupting the Alta industry and giving them the opportunity to think the right way.
You're inspired by nature to do this. You want to protect the planet. How much time do you actually manage to spend in that environment?
I don't spend enough time in nature, but all of my holidays are spent in nature. We have a little tiny house in the French Pyrenees, for example, and we go down there and hike in the mountains. And whenever I'm in any natural environment like that, I always put on my email away message is, I'm not in the office now, I'm visiting my client.
That was DW's Anka Rosper speaking with environmental lawyer and CEO of Client Earth, James Thornton. You can find a longer version of that interview and other environment news from Deutsche Welle at dw.com/environment. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. Our studio manager this week was Ileana Ghilarducci, Leon Becker was our studio technician, Ruby Russell and Jordan Wilden helped with production, and I'm Sam Baker. If you like this show, please consider rating us on iTunes, telling a friend about Living Planet, or subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts. Have a question you'd like us to tackle on an upcoming episode? Send us an email at livingplanet@dw.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more environmental stories from around the globe. If you ever